be here to this talk in honor of Eric Sawyer, and I would like to thank the organizers for this opportunity. So, we're going to do TP theorems, but they're going to be non-homogeneous in a pretty strong sense, and they are going to be in metric spaces. So I'm going to start with some definitions, state the main theorem, and then I try to make the case that this kind of generality is actually pretty useful in some concrete cases. And I will talk about one aspect of the proof also. So let me start with the framework that we work on. So the condition that we impose on the metric space is just this very well-known geometrically doubling condition, which means that every pole of radius r can be covered by some, at most, some fixed n number of poles of radius r per half. So this is usually called doubling, but as this has only to do with the metric space, then we have other things that have the doubling word also, so we use this geometrically doubling terminology. And the measures that we study are these kind of what we call upper doubling measures. We study a dominating function lambda, which is a function of a center and radius, and we assume that this dominating function lambda, it is non-decreasing as a function of r and doubling as a function of r. And then we say that the Borel measure is upper doubling with the dominating function lambda if the measure of the balls is dominated by lambda xr. So of course, basically every measure is upper doubling if, say, it's bounded measure and you choose lambda to be a constant. But the point is that we will tie the kernel estimates of our Calderon-Sigmund theory to this particular lambda. So if you choose this lambda in a stupid way, then the kernel estimates become too restrictive. So, like I said, we tie these Calderon-Sigmund kernel estimates to this lambda. So we have the size estimate, and we have the Hölder type estimates, and they both involve this lambda, this dominating function. And I just remark at this point that our theory covers the doubling theory, and it covers the what is usually called non-homogeneous theory, where you have this upper bound for the measure of the form r to the m, and then these kernel estimates become classical estimates. But with a different choice of lambda, we have a new type of kernel estimates. So then we have this standard stuff that goes with these T of P theorems. So for example, we have these test functions, and one needs them to be accretive. There are many notions of accretivity. The easiest one is like that the real part of the function is bounded away from zero. But there are other ones, more general ones, but in metric spaces, some of them are a bit difficult to use. And then the weak boundedness property. This is the assumption that is used to control the operator on the diagonal bar. It just basically says that it's bounded when we test it with the characteristic functions of balls. And this will not play a huge role in this presentation, but let me just point out that actually to get this weak boundedness property with only balls is not quite so easy in metric spaces, because we use these static cubes of Michael Crist, and then the diagonal part is not actually very easily decomposable as a union of balls. But a certain randomized trick allows us to pull this off with only balls. And then we have this definition of BMO, which is just a standard BMO, but in the non-homogeneous setting, one usually has this parameter kappa, which is larger than one, just to make it more natural and non-homogeneous setting. Okay, so I'm ready to state the P of P theorem. So it's basically, we work in a geometrically doubling metric space. Then we have this measure, which is upper doubling with some dominating function lambda. Then we have a Calderon sigmoid operator with a kernel like above. We have a couple of test functions and some parameters which are related to the kernel estimates, to the weak kernel property, and to the BMO. And then we have this quantitative bound on the L2 norm. So we have these BMO parts, the weak boundedness part, and some stuff that comes from the kernel estimates. Okay, so this is a generalization of the TB theorem of Natherell, Trail, and Wolberg. We have more general kernel estimates, and we have the ability to work in a metric space. So this is not the most general version of our theorem. We can deal with quasi-metric spaces. We can use a bit weaker PMO. We can generalize accretivity and the weak boundedness property, but I will not go into this. So, and also we have more recent versions of this. We have a UMD valued version. So basically the same hypothesis guarantees that the tensor extension of T is bounded at any UMD valued operator. And we also have some local versions. But let me now try to make the case that this is not of purely academical interest, but we have some applications which are really in this upper doubling framework, not just on the classical ones. So basically the first two examples tell us that this covers the doubling theory and this covers the what is usually called non-homogeneous theory. So in those cases, if the measure is doubling, you can choose this dominating function to be the measure of the ball. So this is a valid lambda because if the measure is doubling, this is doubling as a function of R. And the same thing in the classical non-homogeneous setting, this kind of R to the M bound is clearly doubling as a function of R. But then we have this couple of more examples which are like really in a metric space setting and really with a measure that is not of the type in the one or two. So recently Wolberg and Wick, they obtained this characterization for those measures in the unit ball of Cn for which the analytic Bessel-Sobolev space embeds continuously into L2. Okay, so I will not try to recall what that means, but the point that I'm trying to make is that to obtain this characterization, they need to work with not Calderon-Sigmund operators, but these kind of operators they call to be of Bergman type, and they prove a T1 theorem for such operators. But I'm trying to demonstrate here that this also fits to our framework. So basically, they have measures which satisfy this upper power bound R to the M, but there are exceptional balls, those balls which are inside some fixed open set H, which in this case is the unit ball of Cn. But one can then note that such measures are actually upper doubling with this choice of lambda. So as a maximum of Rm and as a maximum of the distance to the complement of this set H to the power m. So this shows that these kinds of measures are like naturally upper doubling. They are not of the type 1 or 2, but they are really upper doubling. And so clearly this is a valid lambda because as a function of R, it is non-decreasing and doubling. And then the kernels that Wolberg and Wick use, they have this specific form Okay, so you have this kernel, and we have made this choice of lambda, so we have to check that with this kernel and this particular choice of lambda, the kernel estimates are satisfied. Well, it turns out that they are. And then we apply our metric P1 theorem in this unit ball, equipped with some natural quasi-metric, and we can basically get the same characterization that Wolberg and Wick get. So the point is that we don't need to prove this kind of a new ad hoc T1 theorem. We can, this framework is powerful enough, so we can apply this. And the next example I have in mind is basically a nice trick of Fedor Nazarov. So he observed that if you work with some operators which are like, they are not initially Calderon-Sigmund, but if you make a clever choice or construct a clever metric, they become Calderon-Sigmund in this new metric. So basically Adams and Eiderman used in a recent paper this very strategy, that they had these operators, they weren't Calderon-Sigmund, but they cooked up a new metric, and with respect to this metric, they are Calderon-Sigmund, and they can then work with this metric, non-homogeneous D of P theorems. And in particular, they got some results for capacities and Wolf potential using this very strategy. So basically, maybe this means that the metric T of P theorems can be useful even in Rn. Well, you're basically interested in the standard metric, but you need to apply the T of P theorem in a completely new metric. Okay. Then, so basically, the one problem in generalizing the proof technique of Nazarov, Trail, and Wolberg into metric spaces is that their key technique was that they used random diadic-crits in Rn. So how do you randomize the diadic-crits in Rn? So basically, you take the standard crit and then you translate it around in some nice enough way, and then you get a natural probability measure for this that governs this randomization. So you have a random notion of diadic crits. But in a metric space, we don't have the translation group, so we can't. Okay, we have these diadic cubes of Michael Crist. We can't just take one such system and try to translate it around, because translating means nothing. So how to get around this technical problem, how to be able to randomize cubes also in metric spaces? Well, the trick is that you shouldn't take these cubes as a black box and then try to do something. Rather, you should look at how Michael Crist constructed these cubes. It turns out, if one looks, that there are these kind of unions of balls where k is the generation, and for every generation k you have a certain amount of cubes indexed by this alpha, and there are these kinds of unions of balls which depend on these centers and a certain transitive relation between these pairs. So it's not too important to remember this exactly, but the point is that one has to notice that this construction depends on these centers and on this transitive relation. So the way we randomized this is that we were able to cook up a way to somehow randomly select these points. So if you randomly select these points, these centers, then you have a random construction of these cubes Okay, so we were able to do that, but you have to get something out of this randomization. So then you have to verify that the key thing that Nazarov, Trail, and Volpe got out of this randomization continues to hold with this new way to randomize cubes. So what one really needs is that if you fix a point and then you make a random selection of this dyadic grid, it is unlikely to end up to some kind of a epsilon boundary region of this cube. So if we define this kind of epsilon boundary regions, then we have this lemma that it is unlikely to end up in a quantitative way, it is unlikely to end up in these boundary regions. And then this is kind of the thing that is needed to construct the to get everything that one needs out of this randomization. One can then define good cubes, bad cubes, and this is useful. Okay, that is all I'm going to say about this proof of this metric non-homogeneous DP theorem. I still want to make the point that this kind of randomization is actually useful for generalizing other results of harmonic analysis to metric spaces. So let me discuss the connection to the A2 conjecture. So as Michael Lacy yesterday pointed out, this kind of a representation formula, which is this kind of random sum of Haar shifts by Hyttönen. This is the key to passing to the dyadic world. So basically, we have many proofs of the A2 conjecture, but it seems that at this point that all the proofs need to start with this kind of representation formula to get to the dyadic world. So recently, Nazarov, Resnikov, and Wolberg modified this our method of this metric randomization to be such that it can be used to prove such a representation theorem also in metric spaces. So there are some details, like in the T of P theorems, one usually uses two random grids, and in the proof of this representation theorem, one really needs to use only one grid. So they made some modifications. They were able to get this this kind of representation formula, and they were able to prove a metric version of the A2 theorem with such techniques. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.